This episode is brought to you by HP Instant Ink. No one is reading your mind, but HP Instant Ink knows when your printer is running low and sends new cartridges before you run out. So you never have to think about ink. For details, visit hp.com/instantinkSpotify. Conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Welcome to episode 183 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today, welcome singer, guitarist Brian Carley from the New Jersey emo, indie, post-hardcore band, and loved by many on Instagram, Penfold. If you are a fan of the 90s emo era, or if you just love the Promise Ringer Mineral, you're in for a treat. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, or if you've never heard them, meet your new favorite band. Penfold, as I said, Brian Carley is on the podcast today. Thank you to all the Patreon supporters out there. I love every single one of you. You literally support the podcast. You support what I do, and it means the world. So if you support this for the podcast, the book series, Anthology of Emo, or anything else I do between the hours of 6 p.m. and 8 a.m., and you want to help, head on over to patreon.com/washedupemo. Now, if you're here from the radio show, awesome, welcome. And if not, here's what it is. There's a radio show. I do it when I can on Spotify. It's with guests. I play songs. We tell stories. Search Washed Up Emo Radio on Spotify. This is episode 183 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Brian Carley from Penfold.
Look back and I feel like we missed out a little bit, you know. I mean, it was such a big part of our lives, my life, playing in the band. And I mean, like, I remember I arranged my college schedule around the band, you know, not the other way around. It was like I would get my classes like Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, and I'd pack as much into those days so that like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, we could do weekend tours. You know, I went to school, I just picked a college that was local. Like, I didn't go and stay at college because I didn't really have any interest in it. I just wanted to play music. I wasn't a great student in high school. So it was a bit of like, they accepted me and I got a grant and I was just like, cool, I'll do that. And then, you know, I'll play as much music as I possibly can. So it was, you know, and then we did that for a while. You know, I think we started and I mean, I was playing the four of us started playing together in high school. I was a sophomore in high school when I met them. I met our drummer, Mike, in a science class. I think he had like I drew a weird, probably maybe somewhat inappropriate picture on the cover, like the paper bag cover of his book. And he laughed and then we became friends. And then he told me he played drums, which he didn't really. And then I told him that I sang, which I didn't really. And then we just started a band and it ended up being, you know, this kid who lived down the street was the guitar player, Rich, and he went to a private Catholic school. So he wasn't in school with us. And he was actually, I think, the only one who had talent, at the moment. He was like, he actually knew how to play his instrument. And then, Mike's little brother, Steve, became our bass player after we convinced him to play bass on a demo we were recording. And, you know, it was like we played covers of songs we liked. And it was interesting too, because the guys were really into like Metallica, which I liked too. But then I was also listening to like a lot of Dinosaur Jr. And Green Day and stuff that I had. My brother's 4 years older and he had this amazing record collection of like Minor Threat and, you know, like DC hardcore bands, like Shudder to Think. He was introducing me to all this music. I remember my introduction in Nirvana was the 7-inch for Sliver. Like, this is pre Nevermind. And a great story on that is my mom recently sold his record collection without her telling him. He lives in Texas now with his wife. And she was like, she took it to like one of those New Jersey shops that's still there, like a like Sound Exchange or something. And she called my brother and she's like, I sold your records. And I have to tell you, the guy at the store was so excited when he saw this collection. My brother was like, yeah, of course he was excited. He's like, why did you sell that? There's great records in there. He had like great stuff that I would, you know, sneak in and listen to. But of course he was always happy to let me listen. I mean, that's how I got a lot of my music. He had such an eclectic taste. So I was listening to like the Magnetic Fields and, you know, he had Green Day records well before Dookie came out, and he had Nirvana stuff before Nevermind came out. And he had his finger on like this pulse of music that the other kids I hung out with didn't know existed. Like, I remember in seventh grade, I got in trouble for wearing a Dead Kennedys t-shirt to school that, you know, he took me to a record store and I bought it, and like I had to put tape over it because I wasn't allowed to, supposed to wear it. I had to put masking tape over where it said Dead Kennedy. So I just, you know, I got introduced to a lot of that stuff that was much more underground.
Why did that instead of something on the radio, or was it because it was your brother, or what did you hear in, like you said, hearing Dead Kennedys or hearing those like Nirvana for the first time? Like, that's got to do something.
Yeah. It was like, I think it was the fury of it. There was like, I'd never heard anything. I mean, I remember listening to that Nirvana 7-inch so much just because of how it went from being like this twangy, quiet guitar to being so loud and so screamy. I hadn't experienced anything like that. And for me, that was huge. It was like, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know like you could do that in the middle of a song, that it could switch in such a dynamic way. And then, you know, my brother was a huge like New York hardcore kid, and he loved Gorilla Biscuits and all that stuff. And so I used to hear this stuff coming out of his room, and I was just like, what is that? Like, why are these kids so angry? And then you'd read the lyrics and you'd learn about them, and it's like they have this positive message, and it's just, I had never experienced anything like that. You know, my mom listened to the Beatles and Barry Manilow, and my dad was more like into like Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, and music was always a big thing. Like, on the weekends they'd play records all day, and, you know, my mom would clean the house listening to music, or my dad would, you know, lift weights, listening to like Led Zeppelin and stuff. And so it was always there. They listened to cool things, and, you know, we listened to the radio a lot. We got into popular music, and MTV was getting popular at the time. But this whole, you know, it wasn't even a genre, but just this idea of independent artists, young people, you know, people you didn't see on TV. Like, you had to dig to find out information about them. You know, that's when like, I started to get into zines and all of that, because it was like, how do I consume more about these artists and what they're doing? And that was huge for me. That made me want to play music, even though I had no idea how to play music. It was like, I just felt like I needed to find a way to do that. And that was really powerful. Started playing in the band. We sucked. We were terrible. And we did it all through high school. Like, we would practice every day. We used to practice in the drummer's bedroom, and it became like a thing. We had like 45 different band names. We would play shows wherever, you know, someone would invite us to play. We'd mess up. We would forget the songs. We would get kicked out, you know, like, just, we didn't care. It was just, we just wanted to play. And I think it was probably maybe, I want to say we had started, we were in college, And my brother was going to school at Rutgers, and we were writing a lot of music and trying to find our sound. And he took me to a couple of shows at one of the student centers, and I started to hear like more of this indie style of music, you know. And it was like there was a band. He took me to see this band called Tullycraft. Them and his buddies were in this band. Interestingly enough, his buddies were in this band who I loved. You can't find any of their music. They were called Slow Children Playing. And the guitar player was this kid, Brandon, who had his called Clunker. And I think now he's like the head editor for Pitchfork or something ridiculous like that. And they were all buddies, and they were like in these bands and playing music together. And then one of my brothers, a couple of buddies of his, worked at the library and played in this band called Dead. And I completely fell in love with this hardcore band just because it was just the sound of it was like insane. And then like kind of simultaneously, I was going to school. I went to college at Fairleigh Dickinson. And I was learning how to do a lot of like design on computers. And the guy sitting next to me, I ended up becoming friendly with, his name was Ben, and he played guitar in this band called Dillinger Escape Plan. And so sort of through that, we got weirdly into like getting into the scene and getting some shows. And then our bass player and guitar player went to school in a few different colleges, and they became friends with a bunch of guys in this band, My Favorite Citizen. And we started playing with those guys. And so we had this weird thing where like we'd play a hardcore show with like Dillinger, and then we'd go and play like an indie rock show with My Favorite Citizen. And we had this weird, and then we'd go and play like pop punk shows because New Jersey had like 20 of those on any given weekend. And so we had this weird thing where we were like kind of sitting in the middle of not really sure what kind of genre we were, what we were playing. But as a result of kind of the New Brunswick connection, we started playing a lot of shows. There's this club there, the Melody Bar, and they used to put on like really good shows. And we started randomly playing shows there. And I still remember the first show we played there was a Sunday matinee show. There were maybe 15 kids there, and the bill was Penfold, Piebald, and Cave-In. And that was our first, the Melody Bar. And I remember being like, who are these? I had never even heard of either of those bands. And then obviously afterwards I was obsessed, but, it was like early days was very interesting because like we were just coming to terms with like, there's a scene and there's kids who come to shows and they care about music. And, but anyway, because of like Dead Guy and Dillinger Escape Plan, we ended up recording a 3-song demo with this guy, Steve Evans, at Tracks East. And that like 3-song demo became our 7-inch and got us like, it was a tape. We started sending it around to like labels and stuff. And we got put out a 7-inch, and then like things started building after that because we actually had like songs you could listen to. And that kind of helped spearhead the path forward for us from there. But I think, you know, we never like had a plan. I think we just really liked playing together. And that was kind of it. And it just sort of, it became what it was. But I think when I look back on it now, I'm like, man, I don't feel like we gave it everything we could have given it. You know, it was like, there was opportunity there that we never really took advantage of and never really figured out. It's interesting to look back on it now and see that there are so many people who cared, or that we had some impact, our music had impact on people in some way, and just be like, man, I wish we had maybe stuck it out a little bit longer. And now, especially in the era of the internet, it's like, you know, I feel like some of the things that were so complicated, like booking shows and all of that, just like, man, I wish the internet was around. We're coming up. I remember like trying to convert files to like real audio files that so I could post them on like our AOL website. And it taking like 9 hours or something. Like that. I mean, I actually was trying to find a list of shows we played. It was like, how do I, you know, I mean, there were tons. We played with, you know, bands that I listen to now that, you know, at the time, like, opened up for us at shows, you know, and were not anything, you know. And it's like, I look back on it so fondly, and I'm like, I wish I had a record of this in some way. And that, but on top of it, just the process of the whole thing, you know, mailing lists, and people used to write us letters, like thanking us. And I know somewhere I have those. Even photography, you know, like you would be at a show, someone would be taking pictures, and then you exchange information. Like, they had to go develop the film and then make the photos and then make copies and then send you copies of the photos. Like, everything was different. And I feel like it meant more. And I know that sounds ridiculous, and maybe it's just nostalgia, but, you know, it's just like, I remember, like, getting photos from a show, and, like, you know, the photographer's trying to be artsy and, like, using long exposures, and how cool, like, you couldn't even see our faces. We were just blurred. And I was like, this photo's amazing. And just, like, it felt really special, you know, to, like, and then you'd get the photos and you'd scan them and you'd put them up on the website. And it was like, there was this process to it that was weirdly enjoyable. And part of it, I think, it has affected the way I do work today, which is, you know, like, still being heavily involved, like having a hand in it, because even the process of communicating with fans and setting up shows, like, there's an art to it. It wasn't as simple as, like, you send an email to somebody, you know, with a link to a Spotify account, and they say yes or no. And I don't even know what booking shows is like today. I have no idea. But at the time, it was like, you made a press kit, you know, and then you sent the package, and then you called them to see if they got the package. And then they said, we got it, but we haven't listened yet. And then you called them a week later. And it was like, but, you know, I remember at the tail end of Penfold, we had released the second record, our first Taste of Escape. And we were picking up, I guess, a little bit of steam in that sense. And I did a lot of the booking myself when we were doing it. And I was sending out these press kits with the new record and the artwork and, you know, write-ups, bio write-ups and stuff. And it was the first time I would send it and I'd call the clubs, and I would, like, immediately get, like, oh yeah, we'd love to have you guys, you know, here, what are the dates? And it bums me out, because we never did that tour. We ended up kind of breaking up before that happened. But it was, like, right at the tail end, and it was actually getting some interest from people, and versus previously when it was like, I've never heard of you before. So that was nice. It never went anywhere, you know. But it was still such an interesting process back then, to try and just get a show. You know, it was word of mouth more than anything else. And we played in New Jersey so much that it was, you know, after a little while, like, people stopped coming, I imagine, because they're just like, oh, those guys, they play every show. So it was nice to get out. Actually, when I did that acoustic performance the other night, someone wrote in that they were like, oh, I saw these guys in a, like, I don't even remember what he said, like, a somewhere in Chicago, like, in someone's backyard at a show in Chicago. And I was like, oh yeah, I remember that show. It was wild.
Did you think of the comparisons then? And did you think, you know, that people, oh, you sound like this or you sound like that? Was that something that you were okay with at the time? And how about now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was always interesting to hear how people compared us, because it was based on their frame of reference, right? Which I always found interesting, because people would say, like, oh, you sound like this band. I'd be like, really? We sound like that band? I mean, we almost always would get like a mineral comparison, which I totally get. You know, and I, honestly, the first time I heard Mineral, my head went to, like, Sunny Day, which, like, Sunny Day Real Estate is hands down my favorite band ever. Like, I have lyrics tattooed on my chest. It's from Jeremy. I've seen them live. I discovered them via 120 Minutes on MTV with the video for Seven when it premiered, because I used to tape that on Sunday nights because I couldn't stay awake right. to watch the whole thing, and then I'd watch the playback like Mondays after school. And so like I saw that, I went to Sam Goody, I found a diary on cassette, all they had it on, you know, and I bought that and wore that cassette down to nothing. And that was, I was a huge fan of that. And so I think a lot of our influence came from those guys. But along with a lot of other stuff that we're listening to as well, just like sort of what I grew up listening to. And, you know, I would imagine that the Sunny Day Real Estate guys were listening to a lot of the same stuff that I was listening to and being influenced by a lot of that. I think we used to get the mineral comparisons. Sometimes we get hum comparisons, I think mm-hmm. because our guitars were so fucking loud when we played live. You know, and then like just random stuff here and there. I mean, it was never necessarily the same thing. But we would get those, and I didn't necessarily like it. It would bother. I would talk to a lot of other bands, and that kind of stuff would bother them. But I was sort of like, well, if it means that someone who likes that band might listen to us, I'm cool with it. You know.
Right, because if someone's gonna, I think that's the reason I ask that is that a lot of people have a certain feeling toward the word at a, you know, during, and then after there's either completely run away or they're kind of okay with it. And I feel for you guys that it was similar sound, similar thing going on. It was the late 90s, and for the sound, that's what was going on then. It was an amalgamation of post, indie, hardcore. Like it was all kind of wrapped into one.
Yeah, I remember we played a show at a radio station. I think our drummer was dating this girl, and she was going to college in Connecticut. She got us a show at their radio station, and the girl who was running the show told us we were emo, and I had never heard that before. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm like, what is that? You know, and I had heard like post-punk and math rock, you know, because I was reading that in zines. But I didn't mind it. I think there was probably a period of time where we would hear that word and rebel against it a little bit, you know, like, no, we're not emo. But I don't really think it ever really bothered us at all. And, you know, it was also, I think it helped. When we were playing shows, it was on flyers a lot. You know, it would be like, because the shows would be so all over the place. It would be like, you know, this band's name, it's like pop punk from South Jersey. And then it'd be like, you know, Penfold, like, you know, emo core sweethearts from, you know, Central New Jersey or whatever. It's just like, cool, whatever. It means the kids who are showing up kind of get a sense of what they're going to hear. And I always thought that was kind of okay, you know.
Don't forget Brothers Keeper showed up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was always like the random hardcore bands showing up. And I think those playing, like I mentioned, all those different sounds and playing in those shows, the kids coming to see you see the indie leaning band or the post hardcore leaning band or the hardcore band. And I know that happens still, but I loved that. Yes, I might have read the one line, but then I still didn't know. I couldn't look on Wiki. I couldn't look on MySpace, Pure Volume. I had to go.
I think that was the fun of it. Even from the other side of being the band in the show, it's like watching the other bands and all of a sudden, you know, falling in love with a band you never knew existed. And I still have this collection of 7-inches of these bands we've played with over the years and I have to get a record player because I can't listen to any of them. But you know, it's awesome to have this stuff, these bands that you would play shows with and they were great and you had no idea, you'd never heard of them before. We ended up playing with a lot of really good bands that it was always just like a surprise and you never knew. And I think that happened with us a bunch too. Like I still remember we ended up becoming pretty friendly with this band, The Assistant, who was ex UNI and stuff like that. And I still remember because Tom, who was in that band, he told a funny story about it, which is we I mean, we were always pretty shy as a bunch of guys. Like, we were, for the most part, straight edge. You know, we didn't declare ourselves straight edge, but we didn't really drink or do any drugs or anything like that. You know, we showed up to the shows, we played, we hung out and watched the bands, we sold merch, and then we kind of went home. Like, we didn't hang out afterwards or getting anything beyond that. And that was just kind of our thing. Like, we were there to play the show and see the other bands, but we weren't very talkative. And, you know, if we didn't know anybody, we kind of kept to ourselves. We weren't unfriendly, but we didn't go out of our way to like jump in and be like, hey, what's going on? You know, it was just like not our personality. And we played a show out in Pennsylvania in like the middle of an ice storm. And there was a carbon monoxide leak at the VFW hall, and they moved it to some kid's basement. And, you know, we just showed up to play the show, and we went in, and like we brought our stuff down in the basement, and we were hanging out. And I guess something about our demeanor made it seem like we were pissed or being almost precious about like the fact that the show got moved into a shitty basement or something. And so Tom, who was in the assistant, I think like immediately mistook us for being like, you know, like snotty little shits about it. And this is before we played, we were going on after them. But we love playing in basements. Like, we practiced in a basement at our practice space ended up being my parents' basement. And like, we were that band. If there was a stage at the venue, we would set up our shit on the floor in front of the stage because we'd rather be at the same level as everybody else because it was just more fun to do that. It felt like we were part of the crowd, you know? And so we got up and played in this basement, and we just went fucking crazy. Like, we had the best time. The basement, the floor was dirt. Like, everything was covered in dirt. We're kicking up smoke. And afterwards, Tom came up, and I remember he pulled me aside and he apologized to me. He was like, I'm really sorry. For some reason, I thought you guys were like being snotty assholes, and then you got up there and played like it was the last show you were ever going to play in your lives, and it was amazing. And he's like, I really appreciate that. And we ended up becoming really friendly after that and going on tour with them and spending a lot of time with them and stuff. And so it was nice, but I think I often feel like sometimes our demeanor or approach to things, because we were so shy and I think self-conscious, like we never really knew if we were good or not, or if people liked us. It set us up maybe to not, like, we could have done a better job of selling ourselves, I guess is the best way to say it. We weren't the best salesmen.
Which was interesting about that time period, too, because the next, you know, era or phase or whatever you want to call it was better at marketing.
Yeah, absolutely. Following that, it became a lot of, like, what you looked like. I mean, I remember, like, we barely felt comfortable in our own skin, but like, I mean, we had terrible hair, like terrible $12 haircuts, you know, white Hanes t-shirts and baggy Gap jeans, you know, and that's like what we wore. We were just like kind of like, you know, regular suburban kids who were playing the music we love to play. You know, and we go to these shows and I'd see these people like dressed up and stuff and almost envious, like, man, I wish we could look cool like that, but we're just us. and that was kind of it, you know. And then you saw this surge of, you know, in the mid 2000s, these bands coming out and making like fanfare of it, and it was always like, wow, that's really interesting. I never thought, you know, you could almost kind of go that route with this, but yeah, it was a different time.
And then how did the, obviously the Emo Diaries comp, chapter 3, I think that's how I found out about you guys.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And was it the same payment that I got in chapter 7, which was 30 CDs?
Yes, I think so. yes, it was 30 CDs. That's right. Yeah. So we met John Such playing shows at Brownies. We played a couple of times, and he was always there. I felt like that was his spot. You know, he'd go and see shows, and we used to play there a lot because it was a cool little spot, and there were, you know, a bunch of bands that would come and play. So we played a show there one time, and he was there, and he came up and talked to us after. We chatted a bit, and he told us about the Emo Diaries thing. And, you know, immediately our reaction is, he's going to sign us. But he was very, very careful about the bands he picked to sign, I remember. And so, you know, and that was like a thing back then. Getting signed was a thing, as it really not is quite as much these days. But you know, we played another show and he came up again. He's like, hey, listen, would you guys want to be on the next Emo Diaries? And we're like, yeah. And he's like, and he told us the rules, which is like, it needs to be a song that is unreleased and nobody can get it anywhere else. And like, we, you know, when we recorded, it was the money we saved from our jobs, you know, and it was like, we barely had enough to spend 2 days in the studio. So we were going, you know, when we recorded, we would kind of do three songs at a time because that was affordable for us. And we had this, we were working on what came to be the Amateurs and Professionals EP. And we had just recorded as a batch Microchip Tuesday in June, or three that we did together. And we so like, I knew, I was like, Microchip's the one he's going to want. But if we give it to him, we can't use it for a while on anything else. And so it was tough. Like, that was part of the deal. Like, you know, we had to sign a contract basically saying that song wouldn't appear anywhere else in that form. And we were just like, ah, fuck it. Let's just do it. And it was good. I mean, I think it was really good for us. It started to get our name in some zines and just get the name out there. You know, there were a lot of great bands on that volume. We ended up playing with a bunch of those bands too, which was cool, and getting to know them a bit because of that. So the Deep Elm thing was cool. We actually ended up, right after that, we played a bunch of shows with Appleseed Cast and got kind of friendly with those guys. That was their very first incarnation. It was right when Ring Wars came out. We played in a basement with them in New Brunswick, and then we ended up playing with them again right after, what was that second record again? Mare Vitalis. Yeah, that one. We played a bunch of shows after that. And so we got kind of buddy with those guys, and we ended up playing with like Planes Mistaken for Stars a bunch. And so it was cool. It was really good. And then similarly around that time, right after that, we went back in the studio to do the next batch of songs, and we recorded a bunch then. And we put the song Traveling Theory on a comp for Fiddler Records.
Yes.
Which was like loosely associated with the drive-thru. Yeah. And that she, you know, she was cool. We were like, it's going to be on our record. She was like, yeah, whatever. That's cool. You guys can put it on the comp. And that actually got us a fair amount of new listeners as well, which was cool. So it was good. Like those two comps were a big deal.
The comps were getting on a playlist today.
Yeah.
Or having Pitchfork give you a decibel number as a score. I mean, that's what those did.
Yeah.
And I just think it's it's a very, you know, even my dumb band that got on 7, there's still people that ask for other songs or, you know, these things sort of permeate. And that's what I kind of was talking about earlier of like, how do things stay alive? How do names stay alive when there wasn't Instagram, there's not Twitter, or those things can go away at any moment? So you saying, where are these photos, or where did we find this? I'm finding that more and more, especially from your era. And I think it is kind of a little bit of a miracle that it's still mentioned and there's this such strong connection to Penfold. Well, you were around for just a very little time, just a little bit.
I know. It's crazy. It's really nice, too. I mean, we got, you know, years later, we had a couple of labels re-release our stuff on vinyl. So Keith, who does
Count Your Lucky Stars.
Count Your Lucky Stars. Yeah, he did the EP. We actually managed to get it done simultaneously, which was cool. So he did the first EP, and then because it was no longer under contract from Deep Elm, he added Microchip onto the vinyl version of it, which was nice. And then And then this other guy at this record label called In the Clouds re-released the second record on like this double. He had a vision for it. He was like, I want to do a double LP, like, you know, and I was like, cool, man, whatever you want to do. I'm just happy that people care and want it. So it was pretty cool. In fact, I was just chatting with Keith the other day because he was like, hey, I finally got like the numbers from selling your record. He's like, I owe you money. And I'm like, oh, shit, that's cool. Cool. I actually told him that I sent him an email and I was like, you know what? I think you should just keep the money and use it for like a band that you're working on your label with that could actually, you know, use it or divide it in some way where it's useful to something you're trying to put out. Cause I'd rather, you know, an up and coming band have something that could be helpful for them.
Of course, there's the I'll Take You Everywhere and June, which we can talk about, but are there other ones that as a band, you guys were, yes, you can say you love all your songs, but just, or there, is there another one that peeks out that isn't mentioned as much?
I really liked some of the stuff we did on the last record, because it was, I guess, weirder for us or experimental, but two that I always really liked a lot was, The Secret Nine, which, it has a bit just more like, you know, it reminds me of just like a rock song. It's got like a bit of this like alternative rock vibe to it. I feel like all the 90s rock influence in that song when I listen to it. And I liked that about it. And I also liked it because Steve, our bass player, sang the verses on it. And I loved not having to sing once for that. It was kind of fun. And then I always liked the song, The Sound of Jazz. And then there were a couple of songs for that record that were big deals for me. And they kind of go back to back, but, there's this song, Kissing the Nightmare. It's funny because we don't call the songs that. Those were the titles we gave them and we did all the album artwork, but they all have these weird code names from when we were writing them. So, I remember looking at the art recently and being like, that's what that song is called. I didn't know that. But I always loved the end of that song. And the recording process on that song, on that album specifically, it has like a really warm place in my heart because we recorded it again. It's funny, when you posted that thing on Instagram, one of the people who commented on it was Steve Evitz, who recorded our record, who I haven't spoken to or thought of in years. And to me, that was like his like, three letter, you know, his single word response to it, like, that warmed my heart. I was just like, oh man, I love that guy. And because I think he helped us find our sound a little bit. Like we had recorded at studios before and had mediocre experiences. And we got in the studio with him. And I remember we did everything. We tracked everything without vocals first, because it was easier that way. And he was like, it makes the process easier. Can you guys do it? And we're like, yeah, absolutely. And I remember we tracked the first song, no vocals, and went into the control room to listen back. And we all like just were floored by how it sounded. I mean, he was recording the 2-inch tape and it was a proper studio, but it just, the quality of it blew us away. And then I was so nervous about singing just because I didn't consider myself to be particularly good. I sort of sang out of the need for there to be a singer in the band. And I remember singing the first chorus of the first track on our 7-inch, which is I'm Never Coming Home. And I got through the first take and then Steve stopped the tape and he was like, holy shit, man, you've got a really good voice. And then he started to actually produce it. He's like, here's what I want you to do. And he gave me advice. He was like, breathe like this. And when you come up on that note, end it like this. And don't say that word that way. Do it like this. And all of a sudden, I felt like I knew how to sing. So I feel like he gave me this like just boost of positivity that I hadn't had in terms of my singing prior to that. And so we just wanted to go back and record with him. So when we did the second record, he had, I think, track CC had either left or it had shut down, or he was getting much more into doing producing. And we recorded at this studio called Showplace, which was in Dover, New Jersey. in the back of a strip club called Showplace. And so it was, and it was like I think Henry Rollins recorded an album there and stuff. So it was like a proper studio, but it was in the middle of nowhere. Like, you know, across from it was a strip mall with like a pizza place and a 7-Eleven and, you know, and it was in a strip club, but it just felt, you know, it was like we did 6 days back to back and we were there, you know, every day from like, you know, 2 to midnight and just, it felt like really recording a record. Which was cool. Whereas the other ones were like, we did it on a weekend. We had like 6 hours each day and we were cramming in as much as we could. And so that one, I think that record, you know, was really, felt like a real deal for us, I think at the time, you know, and we had signed to an indie label, but they had fronted some of the money for the record, you know? And so it felt like it was a real thing. And,
what
and
label
so there's
was
a lot
that
of
on?
Cool stories. It was on this label called Milligram.
Ah.
And they really only released a couple of records. Ours, they actually did some of the assistant stuff and I think they did a few others. But yeah, that whole process, like some of the things that were recorded on it, like some of the sounds we got, you know, the just things that we wouldn't normally have time to do, like running a guitar through 45 pedals to make it sound like a violin and just like weird shit like that, or like putting piano on a song. It was just fun. It was just fun. And it was sad that that was like our last great studio experience. And I don't even, you know, I don't even know what recording is like today, you know, with you can do so much at home and it's so much of it is digital, but that just felt like a scene from like when I watched the documentary Sound City.
Yes.
It felt like a scene from that. Like I felt like we were living in a studio and writing an album in a studio, or I felt like the Beatles or something. It was just a very fun, great time. Even though we were exhausted and, you know, my voice was shot and we were probably all mad at each other. All of that stuff sort of falls by the wayside because it felt like we were a real band, for lack of a better phrase.
And I think working with people like Steve that can recognize things and is almost learning at the same time you're learning.
Absolutely. And he, I mean, you know, he had recorded bands that we were, you know, huge fans of, and he did the Saves the Day stuff. And, you know, we had played a show or two with those guys as well. Like just, it felt like he understood the genre, or he understood the scene, and he understood what we were going for sound wise. And he felt like a friend. Like by the end, he felt like he was a part of the band, you know, versus the other things felt like we were paying for somebody's time who didn't necessarily really even want to be there. So it was really, really a great experience.
And I think that's really important for bands to think about. And like, who are you comfortable with? Who are you interested in to be spending 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day in a room with, and someone that you trust, kind of like a great teacher. You trust that great teacher and you always have fond memories of that teacher or that class. It's sort of like that album is that class.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting too, just to see today how it's, I mean, you know, we grew up in this era of DIY from a different perspective because there wasn't any guidance. Right. Whereas now DIY means I can go on YouTube and type it in and have an expert show me for free. We didn't have any of that. You know, I think I've got some, like, there's some young guys who work for me who are self-taught guitar players, but they're incredible because they're watching these videos on YouTube and spending hours doing that. Like for me, guitar playing was, I tried to play along to a song I liked, and figure out what the hell they were doing. Now, if I want to, there's like 45 musicians showing me how to play that thing exactly on YouTube. And I think same thing with like recording and all of that. I will say, like, some of the musicianship of younger people, I think, has just reached this level that I didn't exist when we were playing music. Like, I feel like we were all figuring it out, and now I feel like a lot of them have it figured out. They're just like, oh yeah, I know how to do that. I can play that. And we were like faking it as much as we could.
Oh yeah, no, I agree with you. They're like, Dad, sit down. I know how to do the I know how to do the pig squeal. It's fine. I watched Zach Wilde do it. We're fine. But as I'm a guitar player too, like I remember downloading tablature off of a BBS from nevada.edu. And right. It was like this server that you just searched and it had tablature and printing it out on, you know, those dot matrix printers. And just like, it was awesome because I definitely downloaded stuff that I wanted. It wasn't just this noise, but I just, I wish I had YouTube to be able to just show me how to play like Yngwie.
Yeah, I know. The best was when you'd find the tablature for the thing you'd want it and you'd print it out and it would be so horribly
wrong.
It'd be
so wrong. Why?
Yeah.
Where's the filter? You spent all that time uploading it to the server and it's wrong? Fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah. So disappointing.
Like, don't you know that it's Capo 2? Like, hello.
Yeah. I know that much. I should be writing this tablet. Yeah.
Or like figuring out how to draw it or like write it out. Oh man. You just brought me back to me listening to like a White Zombie album trying to like shred. That's
I tried to learn how to play better by reading, like, because our other guitar player had all these Metallica books and like trying to play some of their harder stuff, like Orion and the solos and stuff like that.
I did okay,
but I was not that good. I mean, I figured out as I got further into being in Pentrol, like I sort of figured out what I could do guitar wise. You know, I liked weird chords and I liked
octaves?
Trying to mess with time signatures.
Okay.
Yeah, I like playing octaves because everybody did that, you know, but it became more about, you know, how can we write a song with the tools we're capable of versus trying to do something that we're just not going to be able to do.
Right.
I would always get mad. We'd be like writing a song and I was like, no, we should do this. And we'd try it and I'd be like, okay, that's, we can't do that. That's a terrible idea. Let's just do it.
It's like you're so humble doing it. You're like, you know what? We're going to get caught dead if we play this live. Yeah. We got to stop.
Yeah.
I can only write in 6/8.
Yeah. I actually, you know what's funny is I, many years ago, after I basically stopped playing music entirely, I was spending a lot of time with some friends who still play and who were playing at the time and actually still play now, who were in bands that I played with. And I started writing solo stuff and, you know, just like sad guy acoustic kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and,
all over it.
And I realized I was writing everything in 3/4. So I called my project The Waltz because everything was just in a waltz time signature. So I was just like, yeah, I'll just call it that because that's literally every song. But yeah, that kind of got me back into playing a little bit, which was fun. I mean, I ended up kind of guest playing bass or guitar at some shows here and there in Brooklyn because, you know, some friends of mine, I think like a lot of New Jersey transplants ended up in Brooklyn kind of playing music again. So it was fun to get engaged in that again.
So what are some stories of it kind of coming up over the years?
Well, I mean, we did, so, you know, we broke up in 2001, I want to say, and then we did a reunion. Our last show was amazing. Like 2001, we broke up. We played at the M&M Hall in Bound Brook, New Jersey. Venue that holds 150 people. 300 people showed up.
Someone's calling to book a show, Brian.
Yeah, I know. That's my landline. the fire marshal showed up and basically said, you have to cancel the show. You guys can't have 300 people in here. And I went up to, there was this woman who ran the hall. Her name was Sue, and she was great. She was like punk rock mom, basically. And she came up to us, and she was like, guys, I'm not really sure what to do. Like, the fire chief is here, and he says, we can't do the show. And I was like, well, what if we do two shows. I was like, we'll do one with 150 people and they can leave. And then the other 150 people can come in and we'll play again. And she was like, works for me. And I was like, okay, great. So we ended up playing two back-to-back shows on our final show. I had no voice at the end of the second show at all. And I was exhausted. We were all exhausted, but that was a blast. Then in 2005, I forget why we did a reunion, but like people reached out and something popped up. And we ended up playing a reunion show at this place called the Hamilton Street Cafe in Bound Brook. And it was interesting because we played with, we had a bunch of our friends' bands play. So we were really good friends, and I'm still really great friends with this guy, PJ Bond. He played in this band Outsmarting Simon. And so those guys played. And then our buddies had this band called Cordova, who it was a bunch of guys who played. We used to play with this band years ago whenever we were out in Pennsylvania. There was this band called, I'm going to forget the name. They had a really ridiculous name too. Oh, Nooner. And they were, yeah, it was ridiculous. And they were some nice dudes, and they broke up and they started a band with Jimmy from Weston, and it was called Cordova. And then basically they broke up. He ended up starting Beach Slang, which I'm sure you know, but the Cordova stuff kind of sounds like Beach Slang stuff. I have to find it. I have their CD somewhere. It's great. It's like, it's one of my favorite records to this day. You cannot find it anywhere. Again, talking about not being able to find stuff, but it sounds like early Beach Slang basically. So they played with us, and then we did that show. And then the big surprise was the guys from Silverstein were playing at like whatever one of the big festivals was in the area, and they were apparently fans of ours, so they were going to show up and play too. But then they couldn't because their show ran late, so they just showed up and watched us play at the end. So they came to hang out. But that was kind of cool too.
That's amazing.
So we did that show. Yeah, it was fun. And that was a really fun show. Like we packed that place. It was a blast. I know somewhere video of that exists, but it was 2005. So it's probably on some, you know, VHS or SVHS tapes rotting away in someone's basement. But I would love to find a copy of that. If anyone's listening to this and you have a copy of that, and then, so that happened, and then that was kind of it for a while. And then, in, I guess, 2010 or 2011 was when, the labels reached out. So Keith and this other fellow, who ran In the Clouds, reached out, and, they were like, we want to repress. I forget what it was. It was like a 10-year anniversary. It might have been a 10-year anniversary of our first Taste of Escape. So we ended up, Dan Martyr is the guy who runs In the Clouds. He actually has a really cool, he can actually cut the records in his own house. He's got like the lathe tool. Yeah. And so they released it. We basically were like, oh, you guys both want to release vinyl. Why don't we do it at the same time? And then Dan was like, would you guys play a show to commemorate it? And I was like, oh, fuck. At this point, it's like, it's a while. We haven't played in a while. You know, we don't even talk that much. I'm living in Brooklyn. You know, our drummer is down near Philly. Our guitar player's in Central Jersey. The bass player's is like, you know, buying a house somewhere in North Jersey, and we're just like, we don't see each other that much. We don't talk that much other than like the occasional email. And so I called the guys and I was like, how about this? Let's get together and play. And if it's terrible, then I'll say no. And if it's okay and we think we can work through it, then maybe we'll agree to do it. So we got together and played, and it was good. Like I was like, let's pick like four really easy songs, make sure we know them, and let's come in prepared to do them and see. So we kind of worked our way through it. We had a bunch of practices, and, you know, I had a thought. I was like, why don't we do it at Maxwell's in Hoboken, because it's a great venue. And we would play there occasionally. And I always loved that venue for like, if we're going to play on a stage, it just feels very intimate, and it's got good sound. And, you know, we knew the sound guy really well. And the guys who booked there, we knew that. I used to live around the corner from there when I was living in Hoboken and stuff. And I would go there all the time. So I just called them up and I was like, we're going to do a reunion. They're like, yeah, come on, let's do it. So, we did sold out show at Maxwell's, which was just a ton of fun. Empire played with us. And my friend PJ, who had been in Outsmarting Simon, he was now playing in this band called Marigold. So they came and played as well. They were really good. They were another band who like could have been something really interesting, but it kind of, you know, never really took off, for them, but good band. Good. I think they put out like an EP that was pretty cool. So we did that show and that was great. And then at that show, a couple of folks had flown in from Japan. And at the end, yeah, and at the end of the show, they came and talked to us and they asked us if we would come play in Japan. They were like, you have fans in Japan. Would you ever come play in Japan? And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, here, let me give you my info. And like, we exchanged email. And I kind of wrote it off as not a real thing. And then a couple months later, he reached out on Facebook and basically like outlined what it would be like, hey, come to Japan. We'll pay for your flights. This is, you know, just bring your guitars and like pedals. We'll have equipment for you. These are the show. Like they had it all set up basically. And we did it. We flew out to Japan. We had no idea. And it was one of the greatest experiences of my life, I think. And I don't want to speak for the other guys, but I imagine it was like a pretty big moment for them too. I mean, it was 4 sold out shows in Japan. I want to say like, you know, 200, 300 person venues. And it was just amazing. Like I never felt like a rock star. That was the first time I felt like I was a rock star. It was like, you know, you show up to the venue, you sound check, you go hang out in the city, you sightsee, we've got like a translator and a driver. And then, you know, we'd go to the show, and then after the show, we'd like sign autographs and we'd hang out. There was like an after party at the bar across the street where they'd invite like, you know, a select amount of fans to come out. I was like, this is bizarre, but this is the most fun I've had. And we did record store signings, and I played like an in-store acoustic song, and just like, it was crazy. And it was very, very cool. And we did it and swore we would do it again every year. But of course we just did it the one time. I think that was like, that was either 2011 or 2012. I'm forgetting now. But it was, that was an incredible experience. Also, I just, you know, I didn't, the way, Japanese culture sort of, consumes music is so different than here. Like they buy records and they go to shows, and like, there's just stuff, I think, as a result of the internet and the way just technology has sort of changed music, it feels very different here than it does there. Like it still feels special there in a way that I think it's kind of, it's lost its way a little bit here.
I mean, Tower Records is still around there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I mean, there are record stores everywhere. People are buying vinyl and I think CDs still. And it felt different, but it was very cool.
Yeah.
So that was amazing. That was an amazing time for sure.
I mean, to have that many years pass, and I think it goes back to when you do something, when you do call Maxwell's out of the blue and say, let's go do something, there's going to be, it's just, things happen when I think we're not behind our phone or not behind our computer, and there's ways for it to make it easier, but that, in that room, in that space, magic happened, and things came out of it.
Yeah, and I don't even think we realized it. You know, it's like it's amazing to see it now. I mean, the one thing, even seeing your post, I mean, what we've come to understand is like our music has had impact on people, which is really cool because I don't necessarily think we ever thought that or realized that or understood the scale of it, even, you know, it's obviously not this scale that, you know, a lot of other bands and musicians have, but I think even at this small scale, it still feels really good to know, you know, to know that. I think I remember having a conversation with you maybe at one of the emo night DJ
things. Yeah, I remember you coming to the early ones at Idle Hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember I was like, we were like the B-list emo bands, where it was like, I remember like the bands we always played with, who were great, but they just didn't get as much notoriety. Like we used to play, we would play with, I'm trying to think of, there was a specific band you and I were talking about. I'm trying to remember.
That never got mentioned.
They get mentioned, but you don't hear about them that much. I remember playing with Cross My Heart and a lot, and like they were just great and amazing, because it was the middle of a snowstorm, and like we left the bar, and it was in Baltimore, the show. We left the bar and like we couldn't leave because our cars and vans were iced over. And we remembered having to like dig each other out so we could leave the venue in the middle of Baltimore, like a deserted street in Baltimore at 2 a.m. We were the only people out there like digging cars out of the snow. But they were like from that era, there were kind of these bands that I feel like were just amazing, but for whatever circumstances, you know, they have followings and people will talk about them, but it's almost, you know, you have to kind of start the conversation a little bit, get it going.
And also dig. I think you need to dig a little bit for Penfold. And I think it's when there's a larger conversation about music or scene or New Jersey or even Hoboken that these bands are mentioned versus just the ones that everybody just expects.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
What do you feel about the word itself and having the band have the word attached to the music and, you know, still to this day? How does that feel?
I think it's cool. I mean, you know, there are eras of music attached to that word, you know? And so I think for the uninitiated or for people who grew up listening to pop music and got their music from, Sam Goody and Tower Records. And like you say that word and they have an immediate reaction to it or what that music represents. And then, you know, usually you have to explain that it goes a little deeper than that. You know, I think about people I work with who are like, oh, I hurt you used to play in a band. Like, what kind of music was it? And I'm like, well, I could say emo, but then I have to explain. So then I usually say like, you know, it's like, I was like indie, but like a little more punk and a little harder than that, you know? And then they're like, well, what bands did you sound like? And I'm like, you're not going to know any of them when I tell you the names of the bands that we sounded like. So I don't necessarily use that word to describe us for people who wouldn't like, you know, immediately I know would not understand it or would take the context incorrectly. And then it feels like you have to walk down this path of explaining, well, actually in the, you know, in the mid 2000s, when the word got popularized, it was actually, you know, kind of like, you know, like I don't need to be a professor about it, but I don't think it's ever really bothered me to be associated with that, because again, I have like good memories of that. And I think about the bands we played with who were lumped into that genre as well. And, you know, I feel proud to have shared stages with a lot of those bands because they were great. And so, it's never really had a negative connotation for me. I think maybe somewhere in the middle of all of our time as Penfold, it had a little bit of that, but and I think that's because at the time it was getting a bad rap from folks because it implied something, you know, but that's, yeah, I don't have an issue with the word. I definitely don't.
And then again, like you just said, playing with all those bands, having all those memories, like you were kind of watching something break. You were watching these bands, you know, some of them become these giant things. And I think that's why I still go to shows and go early. That's why I still, you know, listen to the random demo submission, because it might be that next band. And I think it's not always like, well, I got to just find the pop thing or the best thing that's going to be huge right now. It's like, I want to know what's next. And maybe that's why, you know, I've missed out on things, but I've also been at the cusp of them as well. And I feel like you guys were right there in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. We were definitely in the middle. Yeah. I mean, it's so wild to think back to that time and think about the bands that we were playing with and got lumped in with. Like when I was doing solo stuff out here in Brooklyn, like maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I would play shows occasionally. You know, like I opened up for that band Gates, just playing a little solo acoustic show and not playing Penfold stuff. I was like playing the weird, like alt country shit that I was writing. And I played a show with Garrett from Texas Is the Reason, you know, as him playing his alt country shit and me playing my stuff. And we got to talking about that. You know, they were slightly earlier than us in terms of timing. And, you know, they were definitely had a bigger following and kind of broke in a bigger way. But, you know, I mentioned to him like, oh yeah, I used to kind of play in the scene. I was in this band. Penfold. I was like, oh yeah, I know you guys, you know, and it was just nice to, it's like, it's, there's a lot from that era, a lot that went around, and it's just cool to know that you're kind of these bands you looked up to, or these bands you played with, or these bands that broke and got popular. And there's, everyone's kind of dealing with the same thing, you know. Like we used to play with Thursday all the time. You know, we played in Jeff's basement. Like they opened up for us a couple of times. And you know, it's just like, you just don't know. You don't know who you're playing with or what's going to happen. But it's cool. It's great to see. It's just really, I always felt proud when like a band we played with or somebody we knew hit this point where like you'd see them on TV or you'd see their record in a record store. I've got a really good friend, now who, you know, I met through playing in Penfold, but then I know from the area because he played in friends bands, and I've played some shows with him, and he's the touring drummer, for We Are Scientists right now.
Oh,
like,
wow.
You know, I've seen him play on like, yeah. And you know, he's just like, he's just a guy from New Jersey. He's an incredible drummer. You know, and, you know, even when I was doing solo stuff, occasionally he would be in my backup band. Like when I could get a band together and get like a, you know, a slide player and a drummer, he would play with me and stuff. But yeah, it's just cool. It's like cool to know that he's out there and touring and still playing music.
Someone made it.
Gives me hope. Yeah. Gives me hope that like, that the scene and people caring is a real thing and can continue on.
Right. And I won't keep you because I hear that maybe dinner's ready or something based on the baby yelling, which is totally fine. That is a ambiance that I like. What do you see? What do you see yourself doing musically? You've got family, you've got your job, and are there music things that you've wanted to do or thinking about for the future?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know if they will ever come to fruition, but you know, I
your dreams
know a bunch of guys. Yeah. I mean, I still have many friends who play. I would love to do something. I have a ton of songs that I'm sitting on. I still have the solo stuff kind of unfinished on a hard drive that I'd like to turn into a record someday. And, you know, I've been chatting with the Penfold guys too, just because I was, you know, I texted them all. I'm like, I bought a house in New Jersey. I'm coming back. You know, they're all out there. And they were like, yay, it's about time. And, you know, and that got the conversation going. And of course our drummer was like, we should pull a Hum and record an album in secret and just release it.
Like, that album is so good too.
I know. It's so heavy. The guitar sounds so awesome on that.
Like when it's 9 minutes long, I want it to be 18. That's the problem.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. yeah.
So I like your drummer's idea. That's a great idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's not an impossibility. You know, I don't know if we'd ever like play shows or anything like that, but I wouldn't be opposed to trying to record something and seeing what happens. But yeah, and then, you know, I've still got a lot of friends who play. I would love to just try to write music again if I could. I think being out in the suburbs might actually be better for that. As I've discovered here in the city, you actually have to have a rehearsal space. So, you know, there were like two years where I was paying for a rehearsal space that I used maybe 5 times in the 2 years that I was paying for it. And I was just like, well, that was a waste of money.
Damn. Well, I think getting to the country, getting to the middle of nowhere, having a basement, everybody close,
yeah,
and whatever sparks from it is probably the same feelings that you had when you first got together. We don't know what's going to happen. Let's just play. And I think that's the beautiful thing about it.
That's cool. Yeah, I agree. Oh man. I could talk for hours and hours. No, I mean, I just appreciate you taking the time. I've been listening and following what you've been doing, obviously not on Instagram quite as much, but it's nice. It's very nostalgic, and it's really nice to see like how many folks sort of pop out and talk about it and have conversations about it. So I think it's just really great. Like, as you said, from that time, there isn't a record of this stuff and there are things forgotten. And so it's nice to go back and feel like what you're building is a bit of a record of that, of music from that era, that is so good. And you don't want it to be forgotten. It's amazing. I feel like since you started this, I've been seeing more and more of these bands pop up on Spotify that maybe weren't there a couple years ago. So it's just nice.